You're listening to the Restless Wanderer podcast with Paul Coulter, and this is part 3 of a series in Ezra and Nehemiah. Ezra chapter 4. When the enemies of Judah and Benjamin heard that the exiles were building a temple for the Lord, the God of Israel, they came to Zerubbabel and to the heads of the families and said, "Let us help you build, because like you, we seek your God and have been sacrificing to him since the time of Esarhaddon, king of Assyria, who brought us here." But Zerubbabel, Joshua, and the rest of the heads of the families of Israel answered, "You have no part with us in building a temple to our God. We alone will build it for the Lord, the God of Israel, as King Cyrus, the king of Persia, commands us." Then the peoples around them set out to discourage the people of Judah and make them afraid to go on building. They bribed officials to work against them and frustrate their plans during the entire reign of Cyrus, king of Persia, and down to the reign of Darius, king of Persia. We'll pause the reading there after verse 5. Opposition to the rebuilding of the temple came really very early on in the process, but it's interesting to note how it came about. So there was a number of people who had been brought into the land after the Jews had been exiled. There were people who were brought in by the Assyrians. In previous episodes I've explained that that's what the Assyrians did. They moved populations around their empire. So they moved the Jews, but the Israelites from the northern kingdom out of their land to somewhere else in their empire. And they brought people into the empire, and it was a king, Esarhaddon, who is mentioned in verse 2, who brought these people in. And these people said, "Look, we can help you to build the temple because we're seeking your God and we've been sacrificing to him. So why don't you let us help you in the building? But Zerubbabel and Joshua and the other leaders of the people of Israel said that they couldn't, they had no part in it. Now, why was that decision made, and was it the right decision? On one hand, it might seem that it was unfair not to allow these people to participate. If they were truly worshipping God and sacrificing to him, then surely they should have been included. In fact, earlier in the Old Testament, the identity of being an Israelite or being within the covenant people of Israel was not ultimately dependent on ethnic identity. Yes, the nation was descended from Abraham, but there was always the option for people who converted, who became followers of Yahweh or worshippers of Yahweh, to be included within the nation, within Israel. And so surely that could have been allowed here. And one interpretation is to say that Zerubbabel and Joshua and Ezra, yes, later on, as we'll see, are particularly xenophobic and racist and opposed to surrounding nations, and that this was one of the downsides of the exile, that they had become more restrictive in terms of their willingness to include other people amongst God's people. But although that might seem plausible on the surface of this passage, I don't think it's really the right interpretation. Because if you notice how these verses are worded, it says verse 1, first of all, that they were the enemies of Judah and Benjamin. And Judah and Benjamin, of course, was the southern kingdom. The exile of the northern kingdom happened in 722. The southern kingdom wasn't finally destroyed until 586. And so there was a period of 36 years, is that right? Have I done the maths right? But anyway, there was a period of time whenever the northern kingdom was being resettled by these people and the kingdom of Judah still existed. So there was history between these peoples. And there was a history of enmity that was there. And I'm sure these people didn't come to offer help saying, "We're your enemies, can we help you?" They come along and say, "We're worshipping the same God." But The narrator of the passage is telling us that they were their enemies. In other words, this is not a genuine offer for help from people who really worship God and who want to learn how to worship him faithfully. But it is an attempt to take over, to infiltrate, to achieve their own ends through this building project, perhaps to forge a kind of what we would call a syncretistic system of worship, worshipping Yahweh, but not according to the instructions of the covenant that God had given to Moses, or worshipping him alongside other gods, we don't know. It says they've been sacrificing to God since the time of the king of Assyria, but have they been sacrificing only to God, or are they sacrificing to other gods? The other clue that all is not well is in verse 3 in the response of Zerubbabel and Joshua and the heads of the families of Israel. They say, "You have no part in building a temple to our God." In other words, they don't say to your God and our God, they say to our God. They don't see these people as fellow worshippers of God. That's certainly one interpretation. The other, as I say, is that these people should have been included. And it's possible, I suppose, that when it says the enemies in verse 1, that they weren't enemies when they made the initial approach, but it's only from verse 4 onwards that they become enemies because they're excluded. It would be a bit silly to try and draw conclusions from this chapter then as to what was right. As often in the Old Testament narratives, the accounts of the history of Israel, we're not told who is in the right or who's in the wrong. We have to use other passages of Scripture to help us to determine that. And so it's hard to draw a conclusion on the significance of this. But one application to us today might be for Christians and Christian churches and Christian organizations to determine when can they work together with other organizations or people of other faiths. I think this is becoming a bigger question in countries like my own here in Northern Ireland and more widely in the UK and Ireland for two reasons. One, because we have a larger number of people of other faiths in these countries. They've immigrated to our countries, bringing a lot of cultural resource and a lot of good things with them. But along with that, of course, it just means we have more people of other faiths around us. And the other challenge, of course, is the sense that society is becoming increasingly secular. And so it seems tempting for people of different religious faiths who share the same moral values or the same social aims to work together to achieve those aims. Can we work together to oppose abortion? Can we work together to eliminate poverty, for example? And there's a decision that needs to be made. There is wisdom that is needed to be applied in terms of deciding when that would be appropriate and when it would not. There may be times when it's possible to work together with others if it's very clear what the aims are. But the problem with that, perhaps from a Christian point of view, is not just as simply as what are the aims of this project, but that Christians should want to do everything that they do, all of their good works, for the glory of God. That's not quite the same as saying that they do all of their good works with the hope and the aim of converting people. Although that's often going to be part of their thinking as well, not that they want to manipulate people into conversion, but that they believe people have a spiritual need as well as their material needs, and they want to share Christ with others. But even if we're not able to share the gospel with someone, we should desire to glorify God. We should want to make it clear that we're doing things in the name of Jesus. The danger of working with others who don't share that goal is that it might seem as if, well, we're all good people and we're all, you know, fundamentally good and all of our religions are equal. But more importantly, from a Christian point of view, not just the challenge that our religions are equal, which, of course, we don't believe that they are, but also that it may come across as if we think we are good people rather than that we have a great God who saves us. Now, there's wisdom needed in that situation, but I think we can seek the good of our society and of our city. We can work together with others in the same way, of course, that the people in the exile had. And that's significant, that people like Daniel and others had worked together in the cause of the good of the cities. Jeremiah 29 tells the exiles that they are to seek the prosperity of the city they live in. And Daniel certainly becomes involved in the political sphere and in bringing order to the nation in his political work. But this instance in this chapter is not just about seeking the good of society. It's not just about alleviating illness or poverty or any of these things. It is specifically about building the Lord's temple. It's about building the house of God. It's an act of worship. Now, of course, we can't draw a straight line from that to building church buildings today, because church buildings are not sacred buildings. They're not God-commanded buildings the way the temple in the Old Testament was. And so we shouldn't just draw a straight line, but it might be more troubling today if Christians were depending on non-Christians, or maybe loans from non-Christian organisations, or grants from the state, or lottery funding, for example, to build buildings that are going to be used for worship. And so we need to be careful that we're not cooperating in ways that dishonour God with people who don't truly worship him. But anyway, these people, and it should be said that these will become, or these people are really the ancestors of the Samaritans of Jesus' day. That's how the Samaritans came about. They were people who were moved into the land where the northern kingdom of Israel had previously been until its exile. And they settled there, and they did begin to worship Yahweh, to worship God. They weren't able to worship at the temple in Jerusalem. They worshipped on a mountain in Samaria. And perhaps the way they were treated at this time by Zerubbabel and Joshua, again, some people who think they should have worked together with them would say, well, you know what, maybe that caused the fracture between the Jews and the Samaritans. Anyway, I'm leaving it unanswered as to who was right or who was wrong in this case. But I think we can certainly draw lessons about the importance of thinking who we can and who we can't work with. Let's read on then into verse 6 of Ezra chapter 4. At the beginning of the reign of Xerxes, they lodged an accusation against the people of Judah and Jerusalem. And in the days of Artaxerxes, king of Persia, Bishlam, Mithridath, Tabil, and the rest of his associates wrote a letter to Artaxerxes. The letter was written in Aramaic script and in the Aramaic language. Rehum, the commanding officer, and Shimshai, the secretary, wrote a letter against Jerusalem to Artaxerxes, the king, as follows. Rehum, the commanding officer, and Shimshai, the secretary, together with the rest of their associates, the judges, officials, and administrators, over the people from Persia, Uruk, and Babylon, the Elamites of Susa, and the other people whom the great and honourable Ashurbanipal deported and settled in the city of Samaria and elsewhere in Trans-Euphrates. Let's pause there for a second after verse 10. Trans-Euphrates is the province that's across the Euphrates. So, of course, the Euphrates River is in modern-day Iraq, and it was one of the two rivers that enclosed the area of Mesopotamia, the Euphrates and the Tigris, which is, of course, where these civilizations, not Persia, but the Babylonian and Assyrian civilizations were based. And so the Assyrians came from there, and the Babylonians came from there, and the Persians came from further east. But Trans-Euphrates is the area to the west of the Euphrates. And so these people have been settled in the city of Samaria, which, of course, was the capital of the northern kingdom of Israel before the exile, and gives its name to that's what the people will be named. They'll be called Samaritans in due time. So verse 11 then, this is a copy of the letter they sent him. To King Artaxerxes from your servants, the men of Trans-Euphrates. The king should know that the men who came up to us from you have gone to Jerusalem and are rebuilding that rebellious and wicked city. They are restoring the walls and repairing the foundations. Furthermore, the king should know that if this city is built and its walls are restored, no more taxes, tribute, or duty will be paid, and eventually the royal revenues will suffer. Now, since we are under obligation to the palace, and it is not proper for us to see the king dishonoured, we are sending this message to inform the king, so that a search may be made in the archives of your predecessors. In these records you will find that this city is a rebellious city, troublesome to kings and provinces, a place with a long history of sedition. That is why this city was destroyed. We inform the king that if this city is built and its walls are restored, you will be left with nothing in Trans-Euphrates. We'll pause there after verse 16. Now, of course, so far in the book of Ezra, we've only read about the temple, the beginning of the rebuilding of the temple. So it seems that there's a lie in this letter, the idea that the people are going beyond that to rebuild the walls of the city. That maybe the case, or it may be that by the time this letter is written in the reign of Xerxes, there was some beginnings to laying foundations for the walls. So we can't be sure whether that's a lie or not, but the implication is very clear. They point to the history books and they point to the reputation of Jerusalem. They tell the king to look back over the archives of the Babylonians. And of course, if he does that, he'll see that the claim that they make is absolutely right. Jerusalem was a very troublesome city. The Assyrians tried to capture it and they couldn't. The Babylonians tried again to capture it, and the people were resistant. Jerusalem, in its location, was a stronghold up in the hills. It was a hard place to conquer. It was a difficult place. And eventually, when Nebuchadnezzar took the city in 586, it was because of this that he destroyed the city. And so they remind him, they remind the king Artaxerxes of history. They say that Jerusalem will become a center for a rebellion that will spread across Trans-Euphrates, and they will lose, he will lose that province, and he will lose the income. Notice how subtle they are. How do you appeal to a king? You tell him he's going to lose his status, he's going to be dishonored, verse 14, and he's going to lose money. He'll lose land, therefore status, he'll lose honor, and he'll lose money when they stop paying taxes. These are the things, of course, that appeal to sinful human nature, aren't they? Not just to kings, but to all of us. At some level, our honour, our pride, our money, our possessions and status. But the king responds, verse 17. The king sent this reply to Rehum, the commanding officer, Shimshai, the secretary, and the rest of their associates living in Samaria and elsewhere in Trans-Euphrates. Greetings. The letter you sent us has been read and translated in my presence. I issued an order and a search was made, and it was found that this city has a long history of revolt against kings and has been a place of rebellion and sedition. Jerusalem has had powerful kings ruling over the whole of Trans-Euphrates, and taxes, tribute, and duty were paid to them. Now, issue an order to these men to stop work so that this city will not be rebuilt until I so order. Be careful not to neglect this matter. Why let this threat grow to the detriment of the royal interests? As soon as the copy of the letter of King Artaxerxes was read to Rehum and Shimshai, the secretary and their associates, they went immediately to the Jews in Jerusalem and compelled them by force to stop. Thus, the work on the house of God in Jerusalem came to a standstill until the second year of the reign of Darius, king of Persia. The letter achieved its purpose. The king searched the history books, searched the archives, and he discovered that what they said was true about the rebelliousness of Jerusalem and the power of its kings, and that in verse 20, the powerful kings who ruled over the whole of Trans-Euphrates and who received tribute and tax. Well, that can only really mean David and Solomon. It was back in the time of King David and King Solomon, back about 1,000 years BC, that they had that kind of range of empire, of kingdom, and they received taxes right up to the river Euphrates because of the conquests of David. And so the king issues the order. He says the royal interests will not be put at risk by the work of these Israelites, of these people of Judah. Rehum and Shimshai have got what they want. They're immediately able to stop the Jews in Jerusalem. And the work on the temple, again, verse 24 suggests that it's the temple that they're building, not the city walls as they were accused of doing, but it's frozen. It comes to a halt because of opposition. So what we see in this chapter is that there was opposition, and we could say that God's work will often, perhaps always, receive opposition. It's normal that those who seek to do God's will come to know opposition, will be opposed. It's not to say that we seek that out. It's not to say that if we don't have opposition, then we must be doing something wrong, but that it is quite common that people will oppose the work of Christians in evangelism, in building God's house. But remember, we shouldn't draw a straight line between what we mean by that and some of our projects today. These people are doing the will of God. They're doing exactly what God wanted them to do. They're building the temple. And that for us means building the kingdom, or the church rather. The temple of God now is the church, but not the physical building. The number of people in the church reaching out to others with the gospel and bringing Christians to maturity. And of course, bringing ourselves or seeing our own lives grow into greater holiness, because we are individually the temple of God too. That's God's priority for us. And if we do that, we may face opposition, but we need to trust in God, because as we see when we read on, we'll see that God continues to use them, and he raises up some prophets who are able to spark the people into a new wave of building. The prophet Haggai comes along and prophesies, and we'll see that in the next episode.